So I'm John Donahue. It's getting late in the day. You've been nicely intellectually engaged for all day, and that takes effort. I'm sure your brains are fried. So why don't we do something simple like schedule quantum gravity at the end, okay? But that's what we're gonna do. But I'd like to take the difficulty of that and try to turn it into a positive. So it's clear that we're not going to do quantum gravity in a particularly technical and detailed way. Even the formulas that we sometimes have to write down are just cumbersome to write down and challenging to get right. So sometimes I'm going to just try to go through it in a way where you can see what we're doing, but let's not pay too many attention to the up indices. Are they up or they are lower? Are they, you know, what is the exact details of it? For that, you need to sit down and do some study. But I'd like to have you think like a quantum field theorist and take a tour through general relativity as a quantum field theory, and at least think of it the correct way. So if you're going to be a professional quantum gravity person, this is going to not be sufficient by any means. But so I have prepared roughly three blocks. The first, which is much of today, is constructing general relativity as a quantum field theory. The goal is thinking of it like a field theorist. And I'm going to want to get out the Feynman rules. So that's in some ways the goal for today. Next time we'll see the effect of field theory techniques. And there, my goal is to have you think of it as a full quantum field theory, not just as effective Lagrangians. And finally, once you see that, we'll put them together and talk about general relativity as a full quantum field theory using effective field theory techniques. And as in the process of doing that, talk about the limits. Any effective field theory who doesn't talk about the limits of effective field theory isn't an effective field theory. That's part of the heart of the game, is to try to understand where your limits are. Along the way, I may touch on various things. When you're preparing these lectures, you're always so enthusiastic. I can talk about this and that. And so this is all maybe. There are various techniques that are useful, fun to see, that tie in nicely with this subject. But I suspect I'm going to cut some of that stuff short. I have a website where I'm going to post these notes. They'll also be on Cliff's site. There are links to other things on that site. There's a link to a set of lectures which has all the formulas that I'm going to write done correctly with all the indices in the right places and all that stuff. Those are these EPFL lectures, which were a longer lecture series that I gave in 2017. There's also links to other things that we'll use. I'm presently also giving a longer set of lectures that's online. Three lectures were given so far. The rest will be in August. Links for that are there if you're interested. And I previously gave effective field theory lectures, about 6 hours worth, here in February at PI. Those are online and notes are available there. So be aware, this is all repetitive stuff because I do the same song and dance at different times, different ways, different audiences. But it's more than you need there. Moreover, some of what I say is techniques that are in this book I wrote with Galowich and Holstein, Dynamics of the Standard Model. That book is now free. We went to open access on that, so anyone can download it. And so there's a whole set of stuff that you get there, even if you're not interested in gravity at all. Just download the book. It's free. It just takes up a few bytes on your computer. Okay, so where I want to start is I just want to start talking about how we construct theories. So because I will try, this is how we do the standard model. I will try to do the same thing for gravity. The E&M is our archetypical example. We want to construct a theory. This is all post facto for E&M, who was constructed without thinking this way. But let's go through it in the modern sense. We want to construct a theory where the source of the fields is the electromagnetic current. And we know currents. We know that if I have, let's say, the Dirac equation, the Dirac Lagrangian, if I look at that, and I said this has a symmetry in it, this has a symmetry, which is psi goes to e to the I theta psi. And if you have a symmetry, Noether's theorem tells us we have a current. So we have a current, psi bar gamma mu psi is the current that you find by Noether's theorem. And if I wanted to make an electric current, I can, this has all the properties of a current. It has the density and the flow of it. I just multiply by the electric charge, and that gives me a current. So what if I want that current to generate my fields? The procedure that we've learned to know and love is we gauge that symmetry. We take psi goes to e to the I theta of x psi. So it's local. So over here, I do something to the symmetry. Behind the moon, I do something else. This is not possible in general because the derivative doesn't commute, as Brian was saying earlier. But we can do that if we add a new field. So we add the new field that allows us to compensate for that. And we write these covariant derivatives. We want a covariant derivative so that d mu psi, if I transform that, goes to psi, sorry, to d mu psi back again. It stays invariant. No, actually, sorry. Let's use the erase function. I want d mu psi also to go to e to the I theta of x d mu psi. Because then if I write the Lagrangian psi bar I d mu psi d slash psi minus m psi, then that's invariant. Okay, so if I have the symmetry, I do that. I add a new field. The new field is the photon. D mu is derivative plus I A mu. And I transform the field by, when I do this gauge transformation, A mu plus I D mu phi. Okay, so this allows this to be a symmetry. But I'm not done yet. It hasn't yet generated the field, but I'm almost there. Basically, I know that if I'm taking the equations of motion, the equations of motion for this new field is going to involve the current. because the Lagrangian has, sidebar, down the way here it has E, A slash psi, so dot, dot, dot. And I know that the variation of the Lagrangian respect to this field is then going to be E psi bar gamma mu psi. And so I've successfully constructed a theory that once I know the rest of the theory, I get this as the source term. Okay. And then the rest of the theory is constructed by writing out invariants. If we know that the covariant derivatives property is covariant, we can use the definition d mu d nu psi equals I f mu nu psi. And given the covariance properties of D, we know that F has to be invariant. Okay? So we now have an invariant by a very, very simple construction. And we can then form a Lagrangian is minus a quarter normalization and sine. Well, sine is chosen to get the kinetic energy to be positive. Normalization is chosen for our later convenience. We've got our theory. There's QED. We've constructed it. And it gives us a lovely equations of motion that d mu f mu nu equals e j mu, and we're set. Now we're almost set. If we try to solve this theory, we run into problems that Brian also alluded to this morning. This operator here is box on A nu minus I want D nu D mu A mu. So we can just leave it like that. This I actually can't form a Green's function for that. That's not invertible. So if we were trying to solve for A in terms of J, we can't do so. We're stuck. We then use the gauge invariants. Typical one, like we did this morning, is d mu a mu equals to zero. And then we just get box A equals J, and we're done. We can just invert that, and we've got E and M.
I'm sorry.
Yes?
May I ask?
Sure.
It's a small technical detail.
Yeah.
Is it not invertible or does not have a unique inverse? It may coincide in the definitions, may coincide in the mathematical sense, but from the physical point of view.
So in this equation here, if I try to find, if I call this thing O mu nu A nu, okay? If I call that, there is no O mu nu O nu lambda equals delta mu lambda does not exist.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, that's a minus one. So if I just try out of the invariants that I have, I'll find that I can't construct that inverse. Okay, but however, this guy is very invertible. We know that's just the usual propagator. Okay, and we've also then get a quantum field theory success out of it. We this is J mu. The inverse of that is 1 over Q squared J mu goes in the non-relativistic limit to and Fourier transformed, goes to E1, 1 over 4 pi r E2. And I get a potential out of that. And so there I've gotten my quantum field theory. Okay, so we're going to try to follow that. As I said, in this case, this was not how it was constructed, but we did sort of construct the standard model this way for non-abelian cases. In the case of the electric weak theory, we knew the charged weak current from experiment. We said we'd like to construct a theory where that's the source of a field. And so Glashow, Weinberg, Salam tried to construct such a theory following Yang and Mills. And it basically goes along the same way. If I make it a global invariant, I get currents. With some structure in there, some lambda matrices that the appropriate ones can be the source. There's a couple differences here, and I'm just saying this because gravity shares these. When I do I can get a covariant derivative. The covariant derivative here is d mu plus I g lambda a over 2 a mu a. So there's a whole bunch of these, which in compact notation is d mu plus I g a mu with, I'm putting two lines under to show you that's a matrix, carries three indices. It's a matrix with matrix indices from the SU2, SU3, etc. matrices, and it gives a field strength tensor F mu nu, which is d mu a nu minus d nu a mu, with these being underbarred, plus I g commutator of a mu a nu. So when you form the derivative, commutator of the derivatives, you get also a commutator of the fields. And so this is self-interacting, which is also going to be shared by gravity. So there'll be a self-interaction term in gravity. And the other thing you need, which I'll come back to at some stage, is ghosts. So we'll do ghost stories later on. There. Probably the part that we emphasize the least when we're actually constructing it, but they're in practice important. Okay, so there's background. Now let's think about gravity. Well, we know the Newtonian potential, but it's pretty easy to say that we don't necessarily want the masses to be the source, the masses themselves. We want the energy. Okay, and there's a couple ways to motivate this. One is the old experiment by Effish. When you form nuclei, the gravitational effect is not proportional to the sum of the masses, but also it takes into account the binding energy. Binding energy counts, so just any change in energy due to binding is reflected in the gravitational effect. So it's total energy, not mass. And also, if one sees light bending, light has light has no mass, it bends. So we want the energy as the source. And in a relativistic theory, that implies we want the energy momentum tensor to be the source, because energy and momentum are intrinsically tied together. They're conserved quantities. In change the frame, energy turns into momentum, all blah, blah, blah. Okay? So you know that. But energy, the energy momentum tensor is also one of these things. It's the current for a symmetry. So T mu nu is the current associated with a global symmetry of x mu goes to x mu plus a space-time translation. So you shift space and time. If the Lagrangian is invariant under that, I get the energy momentum tensor as energy and momentum as conserved quantities, and the energy momentum tensor is their conserved current. Okay, and let me just write out one example because it's going to be up here again. If the Lagrangian is a scalar field, the energy momentum tensor for that is d mu phi d nu phi minus eta mu nu 2 d lambda phi minus m squared phi squared. Okay, I'd like, this will appear in just a few minutes in a calculation, so let's do it. Okay, so what does our success at constructing theories tell us? We need to gauge space-time translations. Okay, what does that mean? That means that we want a symmetry to be this space-time translation, but I can do that as a function of x. So it's a very funny symmetry. Just think about it. It means that over here I can do a different translation from over there. So over here I shift things, and over there I shift them the other way. And that's supposed to be a symmetry of the world. Okay? Doesn't feel like it, does it? So it seems like it's a crazy idea. But our experience tells us that we want to do that, so let's try it. So let's write that out for a minute. But it may work. Okay? And here's the logic for why it may work. Okay, this is going to be pictures, but the basic point of these pictures that you've seen probably before and in popular books, and also here, yes?
All right, I didn't quite understand the symmetry. So you said you shift things.
Yes, so I'm shifting. I'm shifting, doing a space-time translation, or even a Lorentz boost, differently at different points in space-time. So over, let's make it a little bit bigger. Over here, I shift all my fields in one way, and behind the moon, I do something else. Okay, that can be doesn't feel like it could be a symmetry of nature, but that's going to be the symmetry that leads to general relativity. It's general coordinate invariance. Is what that when you say general coordinate invariance, that's what you mean. You take some x prime u, which is a function of x. Okay, and we're going to write out an action that well, that's a symmetry, but we're going to have to do new fields, and we have to do this whole construction like we did for QED, but instead with this symmetry. Yes.
So like what makes this like a crazy idea? Because like, to me it seems like a coordinate change, and like, yeah. Maybe that's not so crazy. I mean,
well, okay. So but it's If I were to tell you that I can, that the world is invariant under me shifting all my electrons over here one way and all the electrons over there, and that's the exact same theory, it feels a bit funny. I mean, it makes me feel queasy to think that such an invariance is there, because I'm used to rulers. I'm used to rulers where those are fixed rulers. And if I take my ruler over here and I put my ruler over there, you'd think it's the same ruler. But okay, so we're changing some of the rules of the game. Okay, so you may feel it's a logical thing, but I think that's the effect of having seen the result come out in general relativity. If I were explaining this to someone who never heard of general relativity, it probably wouldn't sound as familiar. There was another question up there.
Yeah, what is the conservative charge here? Team union?
Team union, the conserved charges are energy and momentum. Okay, so the energy is the integral over d3x of the t00. The conserved quantities are team union, derivative of team union respect to the derivative of team union is zero. So there's four conserved quantities, which are energy and momentum. Okay, is that enough for you? Or I can go on forever. Okay. Well, but so the reason that we have a sense that it might work is that there are situations where I know I can change coordinates, go move to a different set of coordinates, and change what I see it with gravity. So these examples, these are the pictures that you've seen before, Einstein elevators and all. If I take somebody on a sitting at rest in the Earth's gravitational field and compare that to somebody that's accelerating with no Earth there, the effect of the gravitational field is equivalent to changing the reference frame by an acceleration. Okay, so that's when free fall removes the gravitational effect. So changing to a falling frame, you don't see gravity. So all right, I'll draw that one too, just to do it. This person is now floating because they're accelerating down. They're floating in midair. They're not tied down. That's the same as just having no gravity. Okay. Okay. So it's not. Yeah, maybe it'll work. This is just hand waving at this stage, but it gets built into the formalism in a way. If there's a frame where gravity, where you don't feel the effects of gravity in some coordinate system, then we could write down, we know our laws of physics locally in that frame, and we would say that using those coordinates, we've got eta, let's call those coordinates y. And so that's the frame where we don't feel the effects of gravity. But in other frames, we would need to change this description. That's where the metric comes in, g mu nu of x, dx mu, dx nu. So we need this new field. And if we write dx mu is some j mu nu dx nu. So this is some general little small transformation, but a local transformation. So j mu nu of x is just the variation of x prime. X prime, I want mu with respect to x nu. This is some general transformation, general coordinate transformation. The symmetry can exist if we have so again, if I promise to try to get reduce the notation too much, I've written a lot. I would just write this as dx is some transformation of the coordinates. Dx prime is that, and g prime is, if I'm going to do this, I want this to be j minus 1, g j minus 1. And let me write out once what that actually is. G mu nu has to be the inverse of J. G mu nu prime is J minus 1 mu, J minus 1 nu alpha beta G alpha G beta. Okay, G alpha beta. Okay, this allows me to write the symmetry out, so I'm just doing what I did before. Yes?
Just thinking of how
it, yeah.
Do general Poincaré transformations have an inverse?
By assumption. We're assuming that they're invertible. Okay. Yes. Okay. So we're however going to now meet with a success immediately. Right away. It's because I'm now just going to follow my nose and make a construction. The Lagrangian that I would write out for matter, d4x square root of minus g. So this is an invariant, again, I won't bother explaining that part. G mu nu dx d mu d nu phi d nu phi minus m squared phi squared. So I take that Lagrangian that I had before, and I get exactly what I wanted. I find that if I take the variation of this Lagrangian with respect to g mu nu, in this case it's square root of g over 2, d mu phi, d nu phi, minus, I haven't told you how to take the variation of root g, but that's what it is. G mu nu half g mu nu d lambda phi minus m squared phi squared. So the source I've got, that if I construct some theory involving g mu nus, and I do it right, I'm going to get the source of the fields being the energy and momentum, just like I wanted. I also will get, I'm foreshadowing a bit, number two, if we do something like previously, we can imagine getting out the gravitational potential by exchanging graviton, by having something which I'll call it coupling cap over 2, t mu nu of 1, some propagator, which will go like 1 over q squared. T alpha beta. If we do the same thing, we get non-relativistic, and we get the non-relativistic reduction of this will go to something that looks like kappa squared over, it's actually 32 pi, M1, M2 over R, and so I'll get out Newton. So we can foreshadow that. And we can also get out the force law. We get success number 3. This comes from treating the motion of the scalar here. I have the scalar field. Again, I'm foreshadowing a bit, but if I look at the variation of the action respect to phi, I get something which looks like the following. You can mentally do this. The variation respect to phi, the m squared piece is just the usual piece. Here, the variation respect to d mu phi, I then am supposed to, it appears in the first terms. I'm supposed to then take another derivative, so I get derivatives on that. And so I get something that looks like it's 1 over square root of g d mu. Okay, so let's just, we'll call this box, or d squared. So d squared phi plus m squared phi equals 0. So there's the equation of motion for that. And we would like to see if this has the property of looking like motion in the gravitational field. And it does. What I'm going to do this is to let do the non-relativistic reduction here too. Okay. And the non-relativistic reduction in this case means I choose phi to be a non-relativistic particle, so phi of x and t looks like e to the minus I mt times some psi of x and t, where I've removed the dominant time dependence. We know that it goes like e to the I minus I et. I've removed the mass, and everything else is small t dependence. Okay, so that's the goal here. I need one fact. That I need g00 is 1 plus what I'll call 2 phi g in this limit. This is going to be the gravitational potential when we get there. But if I do that, I get, yes?
Yeah.
So here I'm sitting in this case I'm sitting in the rest in the rest frame of the heavy particle, and it's essentially non-relativistic, so that any wavelength of its the in the wave function is small compared to the mass. Okay. So it's basically the non-relativistic approximations at this stage. I basically get id by dt. So this is an interesting exercise, which I won't go through, is equal to minus del squared over 2m plus m phi g psi. And let's clean up the writing there a bit. Okay. So what comes out of this is a property that we've seen in the experiments, that the inertial mass, the piece that enters the kinetic energy in a non-relativistic particle, is the same as the gravitational mass. So if we can get phi g as the gravitational potential, we get the equivalence principle in the sense that non-relativistically, inertial and gravitational masses are the same. And I can get the force law from p dot is minus I h commuted with p, gradient of phi equals ma. So again, inertial and gravitational masses are the same. Okay, so it looks promising. We've got these three successes. All we have to do at this stage is to get the rest of the theory, and we'll again follow our notes. Okay, any questions here at this stage? Yes. Yeah.
Like the G mu is playing the same role as the gauge fields in the gauge theory?
Yeah, so it's going to be our field. It's going to have a slightly different transformation, but we'll soon see something that looks like a gauge transformation on it. The connections are going to be the connections are going to be the thing that looks closest to a gauge field, but in this case it's going to be constructed out of G. I'll say some words as we get there. You had a question?
You said the goal is to have phi g represent the gravitational potential?
So eventually, yes.
Is there any gauge symmetry for phi yet?
I haven't given you anything about the gravitational field at this stage. Okay. There will be a gauge symmetry for this. This is actually, I'm going to end up showing it in harmonic gauge. But I'll explain harmonic gauge in a minute. Okay.
May I ask something?
Sure.
So the form that we choose for non-relativistic reduction, if I'm not mistaken, a little bit looks like, or there's a resemblance with the choice that we do while using Kaluza-Klein dimensional reduction. So is there such relevance, or it's just coincidence?
That's mostly a coincidence, I think. It's this is. This is how you get the Schrodinger equation from the Klein-Gordon equation. It's how you, the equivalent version is how you get the Schrodinger equation from the Dirac equation by this factoring out and dropping small terms. Okay. Yes?
It's covariant derivative, or?
Okay. This I'm not. So here, this guy is a covariant derivative, that one right there.
Okay.
Okay. And here's the technical answer. Let's do it. The covariant derivative on phi is a scalar, so the covariant derivative is just the ordinary derivative. But the covariant derivative on d nu phi has to be something else. It's d plus, well, I'll call gamma in a second, d phi. Because this first other term is a vector now, okay? So this is the product of two covariant derivatives, one acting on phi and the other acting on d phi, okay? That's the technical answer. Okay. So what do we want to do? Well, we have this transformation, which is a local transformation. So let's construct the gravitational part. Okay. We have symmetries like dx goes to j dx. And so let's actually drop indices for the moment. go. The we want d, if I have a vector v mu, I want covariant derivative on v to go to j, covariant derivative, j, covariant derivative on v. In other words, the derivative may have a transformation, v may have a transformation. Okay, so I'll actually write out one with all the indices on it. So if I'm going to write d is derivative plus some field gamma, so dv is that. And that notation means the following. It means d mu v nu is d mu v nu plus gamma mu rho nu v rho. Okay, so this is the equivalent of the like d mu plus a mu. A actually had three indices. Two were gauge indices, matrix indices, and one was the vector index there. The same thing is happening here.
Excuse me.
Yes.
Is that the same connection as in classic gravitation?
That's what comes up next. And the answer is it can be. Okay. So at this stage, I am faced with a choice. I could make this yet another new field. Some people do exactly that. This could be called the spin connection in some cases. It could be distinct from the usual connection, the Christoffel symbol that we use in general relativity. So it could be a new field. But it doesn't have to be, because we can make it out of the metric. So it can be a composed field. And so this gamma mu rho, let's make it gamma mu nu lambda, can be written in terms of the metric in terms of 1/2. So I'll write this one out. Lambda sigma d mu g sigma nu plus d nu g sigma lambda minus d sigma g mu nu. And I'll clean that up before I post the notes. Yes?
So we can have torsion before this.
It's compatible with the symmetry that we have so far. To have something, torsion, spin connections as in dynamical variables. Okay, this is not required to be the correct answer if we don't impose a separate condition. But what I'm about to say is that there is a separate condition that can allow us to impose just that. So if we use the equivalence principle, so the equivalence principle in our freely falling rest frame would say that d, let's see, what's my notation? I want d mu eta alpha nu to be equal to zero. The in that frame, the metric is just a constant. If I do that, then I can play with making d. I then get g, well, let's call it alpha beta. I have it here, equals zero. This condition is metricity. In other words, that I can use a metric theory, in which case this, by playing with that in various combinations, you get gamma in terms of the derivatives, usual derivatives of the metric, and you get then gamma is equal to the Christoffel symbol that I wrote above. Okay? So it's interesting that constructing it in this fashion, you need this extra condition, but it's a natural one to do if you want a metric theory.
You also need to impose torsion free at this point.
Well, this is the equivalent of torsion free. Okay, the metricity condition removes torsion as a separate variable.
Excuse me.
Yes.
Now that you mentioned equivalence principle, if we do these corrections to the mass and renormalization and everything, would that respect at the end of the day equivalence principle?
Yes. Well, if we do it right, so if we have a real symmetry, actually let's be a bit careful. It depends what you mean by the equivalence principle. Okay, there are various ways of phrasing the equivalence principle that in some contexts are all equivalent. One is that the inertial and gravitational masses are the same. That can be violated by quantum corrections. Okay? In a way that I can explain that one in some detail in the third lecture. Other people mean that you can do a coordinate transformation to make the space locally flat. That does not get violated. That's a property of general coordinate invariants. When you start with the Einstein-Hilbert action, you can always do such a transformation. That's what you mean by the equivalence principle. That's not violated by quantum corrections. And the difference is a locality issue.
That second definition means that you can always have like a Minkowskian metric locally.
Locally. And then the corrections, as you move away from your local region, you receive curvature corrections, but it's locally flat. Okay. So. Okay. Okay, at this stage, I have now a definition of covariant derivatives in terms of this guy and that. I have a procedure for making things that are covariant. And so I now know how to make covariant combinations of the fields. If I do d mu d nu on v beta. Okay. We want d to transform like a vector. We want v to transform like a vector. We want those to transform. So this, I want d prime mu d prime nu v beta to go to j. Actually, I've got j minus 1, j times commutators vectors. Okay, so basically, they transform covariantly, so all transformation matrices pass through it. This gives us the Riemann tensor as the curvature is r mu nu. Okay, so the definition here, let's see, is r mu nu alpha beta v alpha. Okay, that's by definition r. And this is d mu gamma nu alpha beta minus d nu gamma mu alpha beta minus gamma. Basically, it's a commutator gamma minus gamma. And I have to remind myself what these things are. Mu, nu, nu, mu. Beta, rho, rho, beta, rho, rho. Okay? That's covariant. We can then form from this other covariant quantities equals here, there's a convention here. Let's see, this is, if I get my indices right, nu alpha mu. I contract upper and lower indices there. And then the scalar curvature is g nu alpha r nu alpha. Okay. So I can define curvatures like this. The for later use, I do want to say for the effective field theory, I want to do power counting. Gamma looks like the derivatives of G. R looks like two derivatives of G, squared G, and with nonlinear factors, of course. So if you're counting powers of derivatives, we get those power countings, which we'll use later. And so we can then form gravitational actions. So invariant actions. Well, the answer that Einstein chose was the following. One was the Lagrangian is, the action. Is that, which is makes sense because this is two derivatives on the metric d squared r g. But of course, if we were really following our noses, we might have written r mu nu alpha beta, r mu nu alpha beta, etc. So they could have been those guys. And everybody in this audience knows they could also have a cosmological constant. Is also a constant is also an invariant here. So we're given this. But this solution is the Einstein solution is just the curvature. We'll come back to these other guys in some detail later on.
For the power counting of the Ricci scalar,
yeah.
Does that also include the inverse metric?
Yeah, the inverse metric is in there also, but the inverse metric there's no extra powers associated with going to an inverse metric. So the inverse metric is nu g nu alpha is delta mu alpha. There's no extra powers associated with that. So derivatives of the inverse metric and derivatives of the metric are the same counting. Okay, and at this stage, the rest of the story, of course, is the equations of motion or Einstein's equation. R mu nu. Etc. However, the story also continues. So that's fine. We've constructed a Einstein's equations from an invariance by gauging this, and it seems to have the same properties. For doing the Feynman rules, we're going to want to have the weak field expansion. So, because we live in close to the weak field limit, we'll want to do a weak field the expansion here is g mu nu is eta mu nu plus some field h mu nu. G upper is eta mu nu minus kappa h mu nu plus 1/2 h mu lambda h lambda nu plus dot dot dot. So there's no closed form expression for the inverse. But if you work out Einstein's equation, it turns into something that looks like minus box h mu nu minus d mu d lambda h lambda nu plus lots and lots of terms. Once again, we run into this feature that there is no inverse for this. I have, if someone wants to try it, it's the equation you'd want to solve is this guy. Let's just grab it and put it back in. Is pardon me? Yeah. Yeah. Let's see. Unfortunately, I'm freezing here. Let's go. All right. So, well, there it is. That's okay. So it eventually appeared. Thank you. So I invite you to try to invert that. There is no, you'll find out that no matter how you do it, it can't be done.
Excuse me?
Yes?
If instead of eta mu, we have a background, like a curvature also.
Yes, well, so expanding around the flat space is a choice I'm making right now because I want to get the Feynman rules near flat space out quickly. To do the full renormalization, I'm going to do the expansion around a generic background, but not today.
So, can I have a...
Sure.
So when we do Feynman rules for the previous theories,
yes,
we just look at the Lagrangian. We don't have to do any expansions for the field. Like when you do QED rules, it's just a field that's already in there.
Right.
What is the gravity that makes you... Like, do you have to expand around something?
It's yet more nonlinear than QCD. You know, so QCD, you also have your one terms. You have terms one power of the field, two powers of the field. This is more nonlinear. But I will also write out other theories that are equally nonlinear to this that are just standard ordinary field theories that you wouldn't have any trouble with, but also have this expansion where they have infinite powers of the derivatives. And we will do that when we do effective field theories. Okay? Okay, so the expansion of infinite powers is a peculiarity of general relativity. But then again, all our interactions are peculiar. There's ones with symmetry breaking, there's ones with confinement. So it's the peculiarity of general relativity. Okay, so there's no inverse, and we proceed exactly the same way. The weak field expansion has a gauge invariance. Which is, if I take x mu goes to x mu plus some little change that depends on x. That's supposed to be an invariance. This works if I choose h mu nu goes to h mu nu minus d mu c nu minus d nu c mu. Okay, so if it's a constant, of course, it's an invariant without any change in h. But if it's a function of x, the field changes by derivatives of that. Okay, so I can use that freedom to do gauge fixing. Gauge fixing it here, instead of Feynman gauge, we tend to use harmonic gauge. The Donder gauge. And for this, we choose the derivative acting on h mu nu minus derivative nu acting on h lambda. Lambda equals zero. If we do that, we end up with a simpler equation. We get box acting on h mu nu minus 1 half eta mu nu h lambda equals this kappa squared over 4 t mu nu. That's invertible. The inverse of that is, it clearly goes like 1 over q squared times something, some tensor. The tensor in this case is 1 half eta mu alpha, eta nu beta, plus eta nu alpha, eta mu beta, minus eta mu nu, eta alpha beta. Doesn't matter for your purposes or my purposes here exactly what it is, except that it's just something. Yes?
The indices are raised using the original metric.
So in this case, they're raised with eta mu nus. So because I've expanding around etas. If we're going to do this later on with a generic background, they'll be raised with the generic background G.
Excuse me, is there a relation between that gauge and this transverse traceless representation?
So the transverse traceless gauges is the equivalent of what we did as Coulomb gauge this morning, where you're looking without the source. This is a gauge that we've chosen that works in the presence of a source. Okay. I mean, that's a bit of a cheat of an answer. There are also other gauges that we could do that are not like this, that only have transverse and traceless degrees of freedom. They're axial gauges. One sees these in the modern literature a lot when we're doing unitarity-based techniques. I probably won't say much more about that till maybe I can get a comment in at the end, because there are some techniques where you don't have to do ghosts and you don't do this particular gauge. I will show you a calculation done that way and talk about it, but probably not present it too pedagogically. I'll just tell you about it. Yes?
Is this form of the propagator, if you inverse Fourier transform to position space.
Yes.
Does it have a well-defined coincidence limit for the equal four for this propagator?
So all these propagators, their coincidence limits are singular.
Okay.
This is just a normal propagator in flat space-time at this stage. And so it has the same properties as the photon.
Okay, thanks.
Yes. Yes.
So to be clear, so what just happened here is that we gauged like a field theory in like Minkowski space-time, and then now it's like once we gauge it, we get curvature and all that.
Right.
Okay.
So yeah. I've been very careful not to say the word space-time. Okay, and I'll. We've gauged the symmetry from my perspective, and at this stage I'm just expanding this around a particular choice of initial metric, a particular set of coordinates where I'm allowing small transformations in that set. So I'm locally flat, I'm allowing small transformations, so I'm almost Minkowski, but not quite.
How we can define our field G mu nu T mu nu in terms of annihilators and cleaves?
G mu nu, I could have done second quantization of this H. Okay, and that would have led me into this transverse traceless conditions. So I have the notes for it if you want to see them. In fact, they're in the EPFL lectures that I mentioned there if you want to see it done. But it's basically you expand H mu nu in terms of some polarization vectors and creation annihilation operators. These are some lambda, some polarization lambdas, e to the I p dot x plus the inverse of that. These guys can be written as in terms of the photon transverse traceless degrees of freedom. So I can make gauge transformations until I get into this traceless transverse degrees of freedom. I can use these, a representation of these in terms of things that you know, which are the polarization vectors that we saw for the for photons earlier. And this then describes a Fock space for gravitons, gravitational waves. So basically, I'm doing gravitational waves, and then I promote these coefficients to creation operators.
So it's spin two?
It's spin two, yes. Okay, so let's just put a heading on this so we... I could do that, I didn't, I chose to avoid it. Partially for time reasons, partially because it's not relevant, it's not needed for what I do next. Okay, if you use this and you work back, if I take a point mass, I get H mu nu is 2 phi g. 2 phi g, it's a diagonal, 2 phi g, zeros off to that diagonal with phi g equals minus g m over r, and g kappa squared is with 32 pi g. Okay, so I have a particular coupling constant. I've chosen to define it by measurement of Newton's constant, and I get that. And at this stage, the Schrodinger equation, the force equations come out, and I'm basically there to the Feynman rules. Feynman rules, we have the propagator whenever I see that propagator, I use this d mu nu alpha beta, which I wrote above. If I am connecting up to matter, p, p prime, let's put q here, mu nu. That's the matrix element of the energy momentum tensor for, in this case, a scalar field. That's this coupling constant kappa over 2. So I'm just, the kappa comes from expanding the gravitational field. And it's the energy momentum tensor. So this is p mu, p nu, p prime nu, plus p prime mu, p nu, minus eta mu nu p dot p prime minus m squared. Okay, so if you go back to the energy momentum tensor that we had earlier and you just take its matrix element between states p and p prime, that's the value that you get for it. And so I have that as a Feynman rule. And there's one more which I don't dare to try writing down. Let's copy it. Okay. But I will paste it in here if it pastes. All right, there we go. There's the Feynman rule for the triple graviton vertex. And you get that just by expanding the curvatures and using all the definitions that have been provided for you so far. Expand the connection in terms of the fields, take the inverses, calculate it away. It's a pain. This is in a particularly nice basis. This is, you'll see a couple forms in the literature. In this basis, okay, I need a particular definition, which I haven't given you, I mu nu alpha beta is one, it's just basically the identity matrix in eta mu alpha eta nu beta plus eta nu alpha eta mu beta. So basically a symmetrized identity matrix. In this form, this first piece is the energy carried by gravitational energy and momentum of the gravity waves, of the graviton itself. So that's, if I was trying to identify the Feynman rule for that, it's basically the same as what it's up here, t mu nu, but it's non-zero. Some of these others, these vanish on shell. So there's a q squared here. So these, actually, these do too. There are several of these also vanish because the q is dotted into polarization vectors. It doesn't matter for your purposes, for mine. So I've constructed, so let's just think about what we've done, just reflect. I've constructed GR from a symmetry. As I alluded to before, I've avoided saying curve space time. I've avoided saying geodesics. I've got force laws, but I haven't done geodesics. But I've been trying to emphasize the similarity to the standard model construction. This is different than you normally see. I mean, I have a very distinguished general relativist as a colleague, and when she starts her course, I sat on her the first time just to see how she presented it, and she said, her first words were, consider a manifold M endowed with a metric G. It's a very geometric approach, and it's powerful for classical general relativity. But I think it's important not to do that when you're approaching quantum gravity. Because if you think of space-time as this curved space-time, and quantum fields are living on this curved space-time, you see a dichotomy between the gravitational physics and normal physics. One is you think of as quantum fields, and the other thing you think of as geometry. And that turns out not to be a productive way to approach the quantum theory of general relativity. So what I've been trying to emphasize is that it is all fields. And just like we can have classical solutions of Yang-Mills theorems, we can have classical solutions of the metric field, but it's still, think of it as predominantly as a field. I mean, it's still a funny symmetry because it does have this property that you can change your coordinates in different parts of the space-time, and that is an invariance of the theory. And it's very easy to get yourself confused. So here is well defined because I'm locally almost flat and I can live in an almost flat world with small values of the field. So here is well defined. If I think about it long and hard, wherever there is less well defined because of this general covariance. But we're going to proceed with that. Okay, let's stop for questions, then I want to do one calculation. Yes?
Yeah. Okay, so it's kind of a random question, but I've been wondering why the convention from Einstein, the Einstein-Hilbert action, you have like 1 over kappa squared.
Yes.
And when you expand the field, metric field around the Minkowski metric,
yeah,
you have Minkowski plus kappa times,
yeah,
h.
Yeah.
So I was wondering what's the reason for that convention.
Well, it doesn't have to be there, but it's a convenient one for the normalization. If you do that, that choice. So you need a coupling constant somewhere in the theory. Okay, putting it in front of the, so that you're thinking about the 2 over kappa squared, r. You in Yang-Mills theory, we could have written this as 1 over 4 g squared times f squared. That's the equivalent case. So there's a coupling that has to be in the theory somewhere. This is a convenient place to put it. If I choose g is eta plus h, then this Lagrangian starts off as 1/2 dh dh, conventionally normalized fields h. Okay, so I didn't need to make that choice. I could use any normalization of the fields I want, but then I'd have to have different normalizations in my propagators. So if I had not chosen that convention, my propagator might have had a 1 over kappa squared in it. Okay, does that make sense?
So basically the eta plus kappa h gives you the right...
It gives me a convenient normalization to do my theory that matches the normalizations that I do for other theories. Yes. Actually, I think he was next, then I'll do you.
How do we talk about these fields? Because now it's like, you know, so now the coordinates, I guess it's like the coordinates themselves are like, well, like, you know, if we were to avoid saying space-time, I guess it's because it's like the coordinates are themselves kind of fluctuating, and so.
Yeah. Yes.
So like.
The fields, so think of it as the fields are fluctuating. Yes.
And so like, you know. But then the fields themselves are functions of points in space-time, but then now we're avoiding to talk about, like, are these fields like still like functions of that, or is it
If you're looking, about small fluctuations about some classical solution, then the coordinates are defined by that classical solution. Okay, so you can actually make this description well behaved in that setting. If you're talking about very large quantum fluctuations, all hell breaks loose. I'm not going there. I'm doing EFTs. Okay.
But
yes.
It is that these two things now become two different.
The coordinates are become a bit of a funny. Coordinate invariance is tough to maintain using standard quantum field theory techniques unless you're doing a weak field expansion.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah.
If I'm,
Go ahead. Okay. You were just saying how this is a different approach than the usual geometric approach that we usually learn. But is it because we have the sketch transformation that depends on the space-time itself that if you do GR in this way, do you also recover things like black holes?
This is the construction of general relativity as a formula, the same formula as the usual theory.
So you recover, in principle, all the features that you have.
Of classical general relativity. But it's a good way of thinking about the starting points for the quantum theory.
Okay, thank you.
If I'm not wrong, there is nothing special about Minkowski spacetime. We always need a background metric to perturb around it.
Yes, yes.
And in this case, we can develop QFT in curved spacetime using these formulas, right?
I will do background field quantization later.
And
but I
have Feynman diagram for Hawking radiations, right?
Well, no. I may be able to have a comment about that, but it won't be a Feynman diagram. Okay. I would like to do one calculation very quickly before we go. If I may, I think I have about 5 minutes, do I, Cliff? Is that right, or should I just stop now?
It's up to you. The natural place to stop is 5 minutes from now, then go for it.
All right, let me do one. I will do it especially quick. I would like to do the following calculation. At least I'm going to sketch the following calculation. I'm going to do the vacuum polarization. And by our Feynman rules, we know how to write this out. It's kappa over 2 for each vertex. There's a 1/2 because dk over 2 pi to the 4th. To part of the d, 1 over k squared, 1 over k minus q squared, times functions of k and q. K, q. Okay, I'm doing it in lightning mode. You realize that each of these vertices contains 2 powers of the momentum, and so I have 4 powers here, and let's just stop at that. This, by dimensional analysis, you can just do dimensions. There's a d is going to be close to 4. This will go like the 4th power of momentum because there's 4 in the integration variable, 4 downstairs and 4 in the vertices. So this is going to go like things that go like q, 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 q in various permutations. If I'm doing dimensional regularization, it's going to be have a 1 over epsilon because it's going to be divergent. It's quite divergent. But the main feature that I'm looking at here is it looks like energy to the 4th power. Okay. That's a correction. That because it's the 4th power of the energy, it does not look like terms that involve the curvature, which are the derivatives, 2 derivatives, which go like energy squared. This looks more like curvature to the 4th.
Curvature squared.
Curvature squared, thank you. Curvature squared. So, and that's the case. This is going to be a divergent term that doesn't look like the usual curvature. It looks like terms the curvature squared. So this is like a change in the Lagrangian, which is 1 over epsilon times r squared. There's some coefficients a and b. This is going to be true no matter what the momentum of the graviton is. So this is q here. This can be q as small as you want. So one of the features that we get out of this first calculation is that r squared terms will be generated. In the action, whether we like it or not. There's nothing that we can do to prevent this, because this is just loops of normal stuff. And even if that normal stuff, the high energy behavior and the divergence is wrong, there's still something that comes out like that. You always get, instead of this divergence, you may get something finite, but you're going to still get these terms in the Lagrangian. So the first calculation we try to do tells us that we're not done yet. We need to have these higher curvature terms in our action, and we'll need to deal with them. And so part of the effective field theory story is going to be how to deal with them and how to make a sensible quantum theory out of this. Okay, let me stop there. Yes, Cliff.
I guess I had a question to bring from online, and I don't know if you want to give the applause before the question. So it's a two-part question. First one was, The first one was, you're talking about gauging the local translations, but he's saying, in principle, should we be gauging the Poincaré symmetry rather than just translations?
So it's essentially equivalent. It's essentially equivalent. We could add Lorentz transformations back in. So, for example, if I said x mu is x prime mu is some lambda mu nu x nu plus a mu, and I made both of these arbitrary, that's equivalent.
Yeah.
Okay? So that's the answer is that gauging Poincaré is the same as gauging space-times because it's completely general.
His other question was, he says that you used the equivalence principle to connect the gamma to Christoffel symbols.
Yes.
But did you did comment that there are people who treat it independently and spin connection field lines, I guess, according to the Calatini story. What are the advantages and motivations of that?
Well, it's a variation on general relativity. It's consistent with general covariance. And so if one's exploring the range of quantum theories that are compatible with general covariance, it's not a silly thing to do.
Is it just a reformulation of the same thing? Or is it
no, there are different dynamical fields. In that case, you can have dynamical torsion. You can... I haven't explained it, but torsion, if I chose the connection to not be symmetric in the two lower indices, that's the phrase for that is torsion. There's the anti-symmetric part of the connection. The Christoffel symbol is symmetric there, so you could write the connection as Christoffel symbol plus something that's anti-symmetric. Then there could be some extra degrees of freedom. If I'm doing fermions, there's a naturally occurring variable, which is the spin connection, which is related to the Christoffel symbol by metricity, but which is related but is not identical. So it possible to choose that as an independent field if one wants to. Okay, thank you. So if effective field theories next time. And,
okay. I have two announcements today. One is, the first one is kind of a sad statement that we need to work, but so you're free to prepare for dinner. The bistro has, we're not in a separate floor in the bistro, but it's also true that the meals are not subsidized for dinner, so you're free to eat the bistro or anywhere else you like that. Although the sad part is that's not true for the lecturers, actually there is a budget for you to do that. But the second thing was more important is that tomorrow at night there is subsidization for the food because we're associated with the poster session. And the new thing is that in the schedule you would have seen that Darren Grant was going to be here for MyStu, was going to give you lectures on carbon logic because he said, you may have heard that IceCube has an announcement they're going to make, and I know that he's going to be telling you in advance of what the announcement is, so there's going to be a nice story there. But the interesting thing is, so he will be giving those lectures, but he arrived this week instead of next week, and so he's actually physically here now. And so what's going to happen is and we can't change all the lectures around, so what's going to happen is that he's going to give a short, like a, probably half an hour or 45 minutes just before the poster session, so it'll be a little bit long day tomorrow. And that'll be kind of a chance for you to get to see him in action live. And then he'll be around here until Friday morning. So if you want to talk to him and haven't seen him and heard what he's got to talk about, feel free to talk to him. This will be here the whole time. And then the last three lectures of his he'll do next week remotely. So the chance to talk to him live will be this week. You know, it looks like he'll be around next week. And for the poster people, I think he'll be starting half an hour later than you think you tried to make. So. But we're still going to feed you, and the posters will still happen. And if we run a little bit late, that'll be great. And so that's the plan. We'll see you tomorrow.